the moment, it is amazing, I have to say. Depending on where you live, obviously, Australia is so diverse, and some areas are still very dry. Some areas up north are waiting for their big, hopefully, fingers crossed, summer rain. But at the moment, there is a buoyant mood, I have to say, in agriculture. There's lots of young people coming into our industry, getting involved in our industry. We seem to, after a lot of hard work, starting to finally change some of the messaging and the conversation in the media about our industry, and there is a lot of positivity about it. That said, and today, you know, we're launching our report card, and it's showing some positive signs, but it's also, of course, showing some headwinds that and some challenges that I think we'll always have in an industry where we're so highly dependent on other factors.
I want to get to some of those challenges in a moment, but we've heard from the government this week. It expects Australian farmers to produce $65 billion worth of food and fibre this year. Still a bit of a way to go before hitting $100 billion over the next 10 years. Do you think the industry is on track?
Yeah, look, we hope we are. And certainly, you know, I think the figure is amazing when we come, you know, reflect on what it was like 12 months ago. And I think
$61 billion.
Largely, of course, probably due to the change in seasons across much of our eastern cropping belt, which has allowed cropping farmers particularly to grow one of the biggest winter crops on record. And I guess also, you know, livestock prices, we've seen some great growing conditions.
Do you think that livestock prices have got too high?
Well, no, I think I was actually just reflecting on the price in the supermarket the other day. And I think, you know, at the moment, the price of livestock totally dependent on the availability of them, who wants them, who's buying them. And, you know, that is the market. So people who have livestock to sell.
So could you afford to buy steak, or were you going veggie?
Oh, no, I was actually thinking it was actually not so. I didn't think it was as outlandish, actually, as it was when we were only getting a dollar a beast. I think the price of the livestock reflects the market, reflects the availability of livestock. If people have them to sell, then obviously, you know, they may well have had to pay an enormous amount of money to get them through the drought. So they're probably now benefiting.
And speaking of grocery prices, ABARES this week also warned shoppers that the price of fresh summer vegetables and stone fruits and the like could jump by as much as 25% because farmers don't have the workers to pick their crops. Why can't your industry recruit people to work in it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Government has chucked $6,000 on the table now to try and get Australians out there picking fruit, and they still don't want to do it. So at the moment, we're suffering from COVID and the closed international borders and the fact that the states look after their own borders as well. So bringing people in from even workers from, say, Vanuatu is difficult because we have to try and negotiate those arrangements
separately
with each state.
But we also have, you know, record domestic unemployment.
We do.
And your critics would say that you're not paying enough and that the industry has a record for exploitation.
Well, I would dispute that.
Not just critics, some academics.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have to look, if there are any incidences of exploitation at all, we have to call it out, which we do. We have zero tolerance. You know, we believe that by and large, most employers do the right things. But it is, you know, it's terrible that there are still some instances of labour hire firms particularly and also some employers who are not. So we don't want to see that happen. We've initiated the Fair Farms accreditation system, which all the retailers are supporting. And we say, report these people. If they're doing the wrong thing, report them. But in the meantime, people are offering at the moment, you know, really, I would say, very good wages to come out and help. And certainly, you know, the conditions, it's hard, it's hot, it's dusty work often.
But at the same time,
it's physically demanding.
The grains industry seems to be able to attract workers?
Well, the grains industry, though, you have to, it's quite different sitting in an air-conditioned header with a, you know, mechanical seat and you know, controlling that
or
sort of thing.
Or working at a receival site. I mean, that's hot, that's dusty work.
Yeah, but again, they're often working in different, you know, conditions, the different air conditions and things. I think for a lot of our work is quite remote. A lot of our work is very seasonal. A lot of our work, it's hard, physical, challenging work.
While the return to seasons has been welcomed across large parts of the country, the story of 2020 really has been the coronavirus pandemic and the influence of China on the trade. You know, the Australian Meat Industry Council Council says a third of meat exports have been lost. We know that cotton's been targeted, lobsters, wool very nervous at the moment, the wine job. Basically, there's not anyone selling anything to China who isn't nervous about it. What on earth do you do about that?
Well, you just buckle on down and you just keep doing what you do best, and we keep concentrating. We know in Australia we grow a product that is regarded, you know, so highly regarded worldwide that everybody wants. And so we try and focus on influencing what we can do. And
so should we go to the World Trade Organization over the barley tariffs?
Well, we have to. In Australia, we're way down the track in terms of the size of our country and the size of our agricultural production. We're not, you know, one of the top superpowers. We're down at number 13 or 14.
So is that a yes or a no?
Oh, well, absolutely. We depend on playing by the rules. We have to, and we have to support that whichever market we're dealing with. And so in the case of the WTO, or any dispute that we have with any market, there's a whole process, which in the case of barley, started, you know, a couple of years ago now, where we went through the different processes in the different countries, and we still absolutely stand by our claims that the Australian barley industry is not subsidised or not, and not, and we haven't dumped. So,
but don't you run the risk of further aggravating China when it comes to other exports?
Well, Xi Jinping is on record as saying that he plays by the rules, and in actual fact, China has taken cases to the WTO before. And so for us, the
WTO... Australia has never taken China to the WTO since CHAFTA over an ag commodity, I don't think.
No, and I think we've been able to, and I think that points to the strength of the relationship that we've had with China, which within the case of barley goes back to 1960s. But in the case of the WTO, it is just a matter of if we've been unable to, if we've gone through all the processes we possibly can, if we still stand by what we say, if there is still some dispute, then let's kick it off to the independent umpire, and that's the WTO. And that's, I think, ultimately it's the grains industry that will advise government on that, but certainly that's the attitude of the NFF.
Do you think that the government has done enough to support producers to find new markets?
Well, we're continuing to talk to government about that, but what I know...
That's another yes-no question too.
Yeah, no. Well, look, the government can always do more. We always want we always want more markets, and we always want to deliver more products, and there's a whole thing around non-tariff barriers and, you know, discussions. It's not just opening up the markets, it's then getting in our products. And so I know we're the envy of the world in terms of how many markets we actually deliver to and the sorts and the variety of produce that we deliver. But we're talking to government right now about let's look at some of our other neighbours with developing middle classes as well, and how can we get targeted products in there.
And what about talking to farmers and exporters and having an honest conversation to say, you know what, we've had a really good run of it with China. It's bought more in terms of volume and value than pretty much anyone else is prepared to pay, and it's going to be a very long time before we see another market like that.
I think people have been having those conversations for some time, and I actually think that some industries have done a really good job in the last couple of years of actually recognising the risk of putting all the eggs in the one basket with a country that is so different to ours, a different culture, a different political system. And, you know, it does when, you know, it's a hugely returning market for us. And it's a real win-win for China and us as well. But I think, you know, it is a risky market. It's always risky putting all your eggs in the one basket. So we need to, you know, and farmers are very aware and exporters are very aware that they need to develop those relationships in every country.
Can you recall in your farming career a disruption to the trade like we've seen over the past 6 months?
When the UK actually went into the EU back in 1979, now I can't actually recall that. I can't recall what I was doing back in those days, actually. It was a long time ago. But the disruption apparently was enormous, immense. And so some of the seasoned people who sit around my trade table say in actual fact it was probably bigger because we had nearly, you know, a massive amount of our trade went to the UK. whereas now, yeah, it's not quite 30% overall that goes to China. And of course, some commodities much more exposed than others.
And Fiona Simpson, this time last year, there was one of the biggest farm protests we've seen at Parliament House, when a lot of angry irrigators and people from communities in the Murray-Darling Basin stormed on the Parliament. No sign of those protesters this year. Just how significant has the turnaround in events been, you know, over a 12-month period?
Well, I think certainly rain has helped. You know, water, it's very hard to share a resource if there's none in the system. So I think rain has helped. But I also wouldn't, underplay at all the seriousness of getting the Murray-Darling Basin plan right. And it's got a long way to go. It has affected, you know, rural and regional communities, particularly in the south of the state, but also up in the north of Queensland immensely. We're sharing a really very valuable resource. And we need to get it right. And there's still a lot more work to do in that space before, you know, we come to 2022, 2024, 2026. So lots more conversations to be had. I think we need to absolutely keep having genuine conversations with the irrigators and the communities, and making sure that we don't keep losing water from the consumptive pool.
At the last meeting of water ministers, Victoria and New South Wales were pushing for new reviews to be put in place, saying that they didn't believe water savings targets would be met, therefore the legislation would require more water to be bought back from irrigators, something that we know that communities and farm groups like yours are opposed to. But at the same time, we had Federal Water Minister Keith Pitt saying, the time for reports is done. Let's get on with it. I think his words were, I don't want to hear what you can't do, I want to know what you can do. Whose side are you on there?
Oh, I think everybody wants the states to get on with it. We've got a job ahead of us here. And it does seem an opportunity. Each MINCO meeting we do here, it seems to be an opportunity for the states to put forward their strong views that they're representing their constituents on. And that's their right, of course. But it was good to hear that around the MINCO table, everyone actually seemed to get on with it and to start looking at the things that they can do. Because I think we tend to focus on things we can't do all the time, and some of the roadblocks, whereas actually if we focus on what we can do and the opportunities there, and I think when you look at some of the projects that are underway now, when you look at some of the monies that are in the system ready to be, you know, put through, whether that we're talking about, you know, water projects or whether we're talking about community projects, then I think we do have to get on with it. And at the moment with water in the system, then it's at least probably a slightly less stressful environment to be doing that.
I also want to ask you about biosecurity, because this year we saw the government finally axe the biosecurity levy it had proposed on shipping freight, raw freight and containers, something that the NFF had been in support of. In fact, I think was one of the few people sitting around the table who told the government that they wanted this levy, which was to raise $325 million or something like it over 3 years. We've seen white spot in prawn, fall armyworm, the capra beetle turned up in the white goods at Good Guys at one stage. There's a host of pests and diseases that seem to be getting through. What's your message to government?
Yeah, we need to do better. We were supportive of the levy, and we were very disappointed after engaging in that process for a long time when it was axed.
Because the government announced it 2 years ago.
Yes, absolutely.
And we never saw it.
And we engaged in a very long process whereby we consistently, you know, the NFF members are very, very, very strong about biosecurity. It's, you know, we are an island nation. It shouldn't be that hard. But we keep seeing these things coming through. So we want, and we our message to government, and it's in our report card today as one of our headwinds, we need to continually upgrade our biosecurity arrangements, upgrade the arrangements we have at our ports, at our points of ingress where product is coming in, to make sure that these things are not coming into our country.
And just finally, Fiona Simpson, I understand you met with the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, this week. Did he let you know who he's going to appoint as the new Trade Minister?
No. His lips were sealed. It seems to be one of the biggest secrets around here at the moment. And Simon Birmingham has done a great job. It's going to be big shoes to fill. So we all look on with interest. Obviously, trade, like ag, like environment, like water, like workforce, Are all important ministers that we talk to. So we're looking on with interest, and we expect that there will be, like everyone else, I guess, expect that there will be an announcement.